Music and Booze with Mo is produced and distributed by Eats Drinks TV, a service of the Center for Culinary Culture, home of the Cocktail Collection, and First Reel Entertainment, and is available wherever fine podcasts can be heard. The Center for Culinary Culture, telling the story of food and drink, one taste at a time. Welcome to Music and Booze with Mo. I'm Mo Herms, and I've worked in the music industry most of my life, so have met some pretty amazing musicians over the years. I also love a good cocktail, and I've encountered some really interesting bartenders as well. It seems that there is a lot of crossover, so when I can, I like to talk to musicians and bartenders about music and booze. Join us at the bar, won't you? Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by Barkeeper, a head shop for cocktail lovers, located at 614 North Hoover Street in Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Stop by for barware, vintage glassware, a carefully curated collection of spirits, and one of the most impressive selections of bitters anywhere. Follow them on Instagram and Facebook for information regarding spirits tastings. That's barkeepersilverlake.com. And also in the Virgil Village neighborhood of Silver Lake, Los Angeles. Recently, I found myself on the road again. Yep, I was in Austin, Texas, and I got to go to Nickel City and meet Joey Hotelling. He tells me all about his voyage to becoming the beverage director at Nickel City, which is such a cool spot. Just the friendliest place, one of the friendliest places you're going to find in Austin, Texas, with delicious drinks and Coney dogs. That made me very happy. You'll hear all about that. Also, we'll talk about third wave ska. Is it awful or not?
It's going. So introduce yourself and where we're at, who you are.
My name is Joey Hotelling, and we're at Nickel City in Austin, Texas.
And what's your role here?
I am the beverage director for the company.
All right, so you make the drinks and everything.
Yeah.
So before that, though, we talked about this. You've done a lot of music stuff.
Yeah. it kind of led me into this career, actually.
That's why I'm doing this podcast, because I find that all the time. So just roll back. Let's hear how you got here.
So when I was 15, I started working at a record store in high school, and did that through high school while I was playing music, because you know that's like kind of the dream.
Yeah.
You know, like Empire Records.
Right.
High Fidelity. Everybody wants to be the guy that worked at the record store. That's kind of how I got my start.
Which guy were you at the record store? There's so many.
Like the weirdo that liked ska and pop punk at the time when I started, I guess you could say, and then kind of. Learned a lot about music. I stuck around at the record store for about 13 years into management, and when I realized that wasn't going to make ends meet completely, as I had to move into like a real adult situation in my life, which I still don't feel has actually happened to me, I had to start tending bar to help make ends meet.
Uh-huh.
And that was a corner bar tending in Milwaukee, which a lot of times is shot and beer forward.
Yep.
A lot of binge drinking.
Yeah.
A lot of, I would say most musicians that were in Milwaukee, you'd probably be able to hunt them down and find them behind a bar as well. So it kind of went hand in hand back in like the early, like mid-2000s, right when you're out of high school.
What kind of bands were in Milwaukee in the 2000s?
So Promise Ring.
Yeah.
A lot of the early Midwest emo stuff, Pele.
Yeah.
Those were the biggest ones, I would say.
So you have relationships with those guys,
right?
Because you're serving them their shots.
Yeah, Scott actually is still a pretty good friend of mine. He's a Dashboard Confessional now. They all were just here, like, last April partying, so that was pretty fun.
That's nice.
To keep up with all those people for over the years.
That's amazing. So, but you did tour managing too?
No.
Did you fall into that?
No, okay. I did tour a little bit in the early 2000s and various punk bands. Guitar and trombone, because I did the whole ska thing, but The reason
you
I took
were kidding guitar. And
no,
drum
I wasn't. Yeah, I'm like definitely not ashamed to admit it.
Well, which instrument did you pick up first?
Oh, guitar for sure.
Okay.
I actually picked up trombone because I could fill high school credits with it and not have to take like another English class.
Oh my God, that's hilarious.
So if you had to do like a mandatory 3 years of English, or you could pick up another elective that was like music or arts forward. So I'm like, I'm gonna learn how to play trombone. And man, and I it was a great and awful experience all at the same time, because I picked probably one of the harder brass instruments to really get good at. But it's after picking it up for like 4 months, I ended up making jazz too in high school, which was a pretty big deal back at Pius, because they had a pretty esteemed jazz program there.
That's amazing.
So that was pretty fun, and I couldn't play a lick of that thing anymore. It's been 20 years or so, I would say.
So you mentioned, excuse me, there's that cedar getting my throat. You mentioned the ska stuff, and so that would have been like third wave, right? Which is the
the more ska punk genre. I actually, when I was 18, I was playing in a band that was very established in Milwaukee and started touring around the Midwest called 5 O'Clock Charlie, and I was like the baby in the band. When I joined the band, I wasn't even old enough to drink, so I was going in and out of these venues with one other horn player, and everybody in Milwaukee for the longest time just assumed I was 21.
Yeah, totally.
So there was really no limits to where I could go in the music scene, too, so I remember seeing like Interpol underage and a bunch of other really cool acts by just like playing it cool, being like, oh yeah, I'm Joey from 5 O'Clock Try. I met you last night while we played here, and just like didn't drink and just like
was just like
the quiet kid in the corner all the time at these shows. So I condone that activity at all, going into bars underage, obviously. But you know, when you're that age, you know, you're reckless and you say fuck no to rules. You
so
know,
what kind of bands were you in then?
I did the ska band thing, and then I was in like a power pop band that did the Warped Tour a couple years.
Yeah. So what was it that made you pick up the guitar?
I don't know. I always thought like, well, first off, everybody thought it was cool when you were younger. You're like, man, look at how cool Billy Joe looks like from Green Day playing that thing during the Dookie era and a little bit before that. And then I heard NOFX and a bunch of other bands. Maybe I'm not going to admit that I'm super into anymore for various reasons, but those were definitely the reasons.
Yeah.
In middle school, one of my friends, his dad owned a really cool little rap club called the Unicorn.
Okay.
So I also spent a lot of time there, like hanging out with Art Alexakis from Everclear and all these other weird people that are rock stars now, like coming in and out of the venue and his house even. Some of the people from Smashing Pumpkins would come up and work for him when they weren't touring to sober up and whatnot. So I got to meet a lot of these like cool people when I was younger, I guess. And
that's
I was
amazing.
Just like, I want to do that when I'm older. And then I kind of came to the realization like, wow, gas prices are going up. Touring's not even an option anymore. I mean, I think to tour around the country, I just read an article like $6,000 in gas if you have like a pretty efficient van nowadays. So I don't know how artists do it. I also like, you see ticket prices go up now.
I don't even try to go to shows anymore. I don't understand how it works. I'm just, you know, like they just announced that The Cure was touring, right?
Right.
And I saw on social media, friends of mine, they're just like, I didn't even get into the queue to buy a ticket to The Cure, and the resale ticks are so high. And I'm just like, okay, thank God for little club shows, you know, that roll around, because
well,
that's
I think
like it.
People don't realize the $10 show now is $30.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because some of those indie bands or some of the smaller bands aren't seeing anything back from record sales anymore.
Oh, totally.
So like Bandcamp and Spotify and all these things. Bandcamp they can control a little bit, but like Spotify and Apple Music, they don't see any money from that. So I always tell people that are guest listed for things, like make sure you buy a t-shirt. Make sure you just buy something from them. Just throw a 20 at the merch booth or anything, because they're not seeing money from alcohol sales either, which is kind of bullshit if you think about it.
Oh, totally.
Where they're paying a percentage on their merch sales back to the venue, they're not seeing anything back from alcohol sales, which I think is a platform that some artists are starting to speak up against.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty cool, because in the real world, that's kind of how it should work. If you have a sold-out show and your alcohol sales are, you know, 50K, and you're not seeing a dollar from that, whereas you're selling 25K in merch and forking over 25% of the venue, I'm like, that's a real head-scratcher if you think about it. Like,
absolutely. It's going to take some time before they
But I have seen some people that I know that do both, like, kind of speaking up against it.
You know,
yeah, I hope it is, because that's how we're going to, live music's
going
to survive without us having to pay $1,000 to go to a show, you know?
Right? Well, you pay $1,000 to go to a show, and I'm still wondering how much of that the artist is actually going to see.
Right.
I mean, dynamic pricing, who actually makes the money from that? It's the big ticket.
And then now this, the new Q thing, where, like, the prices go up based on demand, which is just like, an insane platform.
Which is ridiculous.
Like, I don't think any artist that is making that amount of money even cares that if there's 400 people in the queue, the tickets are going to be more than if there's 100 people in the queue.
Yeah, totally. Well, that's makes me think, like, what was your first concert? I mean, my first concert was a big stadium show.
Candlebox?
Yeah, mine was Donnie and Marie, because I'm old. And
what
my
was
parent,
it?
Donnie and Marie.
Okay.
And my parents took me when I was a little girl, right? And we had nosebleed seats, but, I mean, I'm sure those tickets cost them, like, almost nothing.
Right.
I remember going to see, like, for example, The Cure in high school and at a stadium show. And it didn't cost anything. I was a high school student, and I could buy tickets to that show. I can't imagine a high school student being able to buy tickets to see the band that they love, the artist that they love in this day and age.
Right.
It is. What was your first show? Do you remember?
Yeah, my first one was Candlebox. My uncles used to drag me to shows.
Yeah.
And then I think Bush might have been my second one.
Nice. You get the 90s
my first
thing.
Memorable expensive concert, though. Uh-huh. Was Elvis Costello, and I think I paid $45. It was just like outraged to pay $45 to see Elvis Costello. But in the grand scheme of things, we were third row. So I mean, looking back, that ticket probably would be $500 now.
Yeah,
you never know.
Who knows?
But when you see bands like, not that I'm going to knock anything on Paramore because I think they're actually pretty cool with the way they progress, but like a Blink-182 of the world, where it's just like it's going to be the same shit they did 20 years ago, the same shitty product outside of the drummer. And their tickets are going for, you know, $1,500 for, like, an upper-level seat in Los Angeles is completely and utterly ridiculous to me. None of those guys need that money.
So, so you started bartending to offset the, I mean, anyone who wants to be a musician to live has to know that they're getting into, like, the poverty zone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's basically no way. So you started bartending to offset your musical hobby.
Right.
Or your wish for music. And so how did that take over?
I realized how much more money I made tending bar than running the record store, unfortunately. There were perks to the record store, like promotional CDs and your discount. You know, at one point, I think I gathered about 18,000 promotional CDs, which I sold off to a used bookstore. I won't mention the chain's name. But so that was kind of like an insurance policy for when I did end up leaving and go full into the bar. And then after about 4 years of just tending bar, I started realizing, like, hey, maybe I should learn more about this profession. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of when I dove headfirst into cocktails and learning more about spirits.
And was that all in Milwaukee
where
that was happening? Mm-hmm. So Milwaukee, I know now, from what I understand, has a really, like, kind of cute waterfront sort of thing going on, and they've come up in the cuisine and cocktail world. But at that time, what were you finding?
It was still much a school of hard knocks learning.
Yeah.
There was a couple guys that were there that were really good, and I kind of just put myself near them all the time.
Yeah.
Whether it was sitting in their well, constantly tasting all the drinks they were making, seeking out advice to the point where they probably just wanted to punch me in the face because I was so annoying about it. And just kind of following them around and learning the ropes from a couple key guys that are doing really well nationally as far as like competitions and learning. And
so you started doing the competition circuit too?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah.
I found that to be kind of tedious after a while too, where people aren't spending $500-$600 to make one drink look cool. Not really my speed. I'm like a four ingredients.
Yeah.
Maybe a bitters in there, something to modify it, but you know, you can do a lot with four ingredients that you don't need the whole kitchen sink in there.
Yeah. So when did you start finding yourself kind of in more of a lead position? Eventually. I mean, you're a beverage director now, so you have to get there.
Being forced into it, people quitting a lot of times. You know, the cocktail scene was expanding really fast in Milwaukee. But again, it was like very few places people would actually want to go for the drinks. So you kind of were making your own name at your own spot a lot of times, and you're doing your own little thing there, more so than like walking into a program that was already established. Mm-hmm. Where when I came here, the program was pretty much already established. It was just someone to keep it afloat as the expansion moved forward.
When you say here, you mean here at Nickel
City?
Yeah,
here at Nickel City.
So what brought you to Austin in the first place?
I got displaced in a tornado. No, I just,
No,
that was a joke. It was like the Wizard of Oz story. It was a lot of fear of winter again.
Like tornadoes in places that don't have tornadoes anymore.
Is it fear of winter? Would that be it? I don't know.
But you were born and raised in Milwaukee, right?
Yeah, Travis Stober and I had been pretty close friends for about 11 years, so we had danced around the idea a lot of me coming down and hanging out and working for him. Once Fort Worth was opening, they were moving some people out there.
Yeah.
And I'd already come down a couple times to like help out for a month here and there during like Sip and Santa and whatnot. So I was like, hey, I'll come down and help you while you open Fort Worth. So I literally threw the corgi in the van and some stuff for about a month. And then I think it was about 3-4 weeks later, I decided this is probably a better career move for me than going back to Milwaukee, as the financially you're a lot more stable here, even though things are a little more expensive.
Yeah.
There's no like oh man, is February gonna put me under this year here? Yeah. You know, like there's a lot more stability with a place that's this established and
moving forward. Like,
so,
I mean, Nickel City opened up and it became like what, like a country darling, and it, but not by country music. I mean,
right.
In the United States, this is a place where people who like their cocktails always want to pop by and
even more so just their shot and beer and want to, you know, sit down and talk to someone they don't know at the bar. And
well, you know, I mean, that's what a bar's all about,
mm-hmm.
at the end of the day. So, I mean, is that what keeps you here?
This was also a really good fit for me because if you walk in here, you could easily just take this bar and sit it in Milwaukee and it would work too.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's got a very Rust Belt Midwest feel to it. And well, if you kind of travel like from Milwaukee all the way to Buffalo, I think these are the kind of bars that you're running into more often than not now.
It's not a pretentious space. It's just a welcoming space and anybody can walk in and feel like they can sit down, like you said, and just say hey, which is what I always thought a bar is supposed to be. I mean, granted, we've learned now there are a couple different definitions of bar now. You've got the fancy bars, which there's a time and a place for that stuff if you want to go in and have like a cocktail that does have the kitchen sink in it and somebody works very specifically on that, but then a place where you want to just sit down and kind of just chill for a while. It's that third space. So how long have you been with Nickel City then?
This is year three for me.
Three? So you came like right pandemic time.
Yeah, like right in the middle of it.
Oh,
like,
wow.
There was still a shield up on the bar when I got here. So
oh my God.
We were running table service at that point, which was also new for me being in Milwaukee. Unless you were a server, you never left behind the bar.
Our bar, I mean,
it was frowned upon, you know, like, servers didn't go back there and we didn't go out here, you know, like unless we were helping helping them run something or bust something. But yeah, it was definitely a learning experience.
Well, everybody like did weird things during that time just to get by.
Right.
You know? And now you're back. So tell me about like when you started learning, you were talking before about learning from these old guys that you like glommed onto and learning about spirits. What were some of the discoveries that you started making like when you started doing that?
That I didn't know shit.
Yeah.
Like literally, you think you know a lot about something and you literally don't know a damn thing. So one of my first experiences learning was with Al Young from Four Roses, who offered us the luxury of having his personal phone number and email, which was a huge mistake for him with me. He was definitely very influential in all of my bourbon knowledge that I've gained throughout the years, because I would literally ask him questions about everything. Because when he offered, he said, even if it's not Four Roses, feel free to reach out. I love talking about bourbon. So I think up until he passed a couple years ago, it was like a monthly email or bi-weekly email he would get from me. Then he would tell me, because he'd worked for a billion different brands before that and had a really great history.
So he was a mentor for you, basically. You forced him to be your mentor.
Yeah, I forced him to. That's normally how it works with me, is I like force you to give me what I want as far as knowledge. I'll stick around until you finally just crack and give it to me, you know?
Was it like that with guitar, too?
No, that was all school hard knocks.
What, how old were you when you grabbed a guitar, when you first picked it up?
12.
12? So did you have to, like, talk your parents into buying that for you, or did you like?
Yeah, it wasn't. They regretted it. I stayed with my grandparents, but they bought me like a Samick guitar, which I don't even if that company is even a thing anymore. And
mine was from JCPenney's or Sears. I can't remember which, so I don't know what.
It probably was the same thing.
Probably,
I mean, Best Buy.
Mine was an acoustic. Yeah, I just grabbed there.
Oh, I definitely went right for the electric. I'm like, I don't want an acoustic. That's, you know,
I'm a girl. I was like 8, so I was like, I just want to strum around to figure it out.
And I got like a little.
You went full boy.
Yeah, I don't even know what the amp model was, but it had no distortion. And man, was that just like horrifying until I learned what a distortion pedal was. Even then, it was probably even more horrifying for the household. And then I just kind of like, just kept sticking with it and sticking with it and sticking with it. Next thing you know, I'm playing in really bad punk and ska bands.
Oh my God. What was the first song you tried to teach yourself on there?
Oh my God. It had to have been like, geez, maybe like a 7 Mary 3 song or something that was on the radio. Who even knows at this point?
Too heavy, too light, too black or too white, too wrong or too right, today or tonight, come on for song. Too rich or too poor, she's wanting me less and I'm wanting no more. The bitter taste is come soon. No, yeah, no, no, no.
When you started playing, like with other people, were you like the best thing in the whole world in your own mind at that point?
Oh no, I was like the worst thing. I was like, I gotta find a good drummer. Because so that was the key. I'm like, if I find a good drummer, I'll learn this faster.
Oh, wow.
Kind of deal. And that's like, if so I find a better guitarist, I'll just steal all of his riffs. You know, that was my mentality. Like, bass, whatever. They can just do around. You know, it wasn't like
Who did you want to play like?
I didn't even have a plan. I don't know. At that point, I probably just wanted to be like,
to be cool.
The next NoFX at that point when I started playing in bands or like
some
leg wagon or something like that. Who knows?
Nice. Well, you mentioned Rocket. Rocket, and that's like I'm from San Diego. I was a huge Rocket fan all the time, so I love that they made it into your.
That was from working at the record store, because that was the cool thing about working at the record store is you know, no two people are the same, and back then you know there was no iPods or iPads or anything, no Apple Music. Had just started towards the end of my tenure at the record store.
I mean, then it was still like
LimeWire. So you had CDs, so people
still downloading illegally off of LimeWire, right?
Right, that's how I used to spend my 4th of July. all these people would be bringing their collections to listen to at work and trying to sell these different albums, and I had a guy that was really, really into all sorts of eclectic things. Like, he got me really into Mr. Bungle.
Oh,
and he got me really into Rocket from the Crypt. And I was already kind of a Faith No More fan, so then he took me in like the Zodiac record stuff, like Mike Patton's just making music with a bunch of guitar pedals with his vocals, and
I know, totally.
And then Mark Rebo stuff, and then that brought me to Tom Waits, and then it just
all the, weird
the ball
shit.
Just rolled down the hill and kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger, and then like the same thing kind of happened with hip hop with me. Like, Midwest had a pretty cool hip hop scene coming out of Minneapolis at the time, and so that just kind of shot me all different directions, and it keeps happening. I think that's the coolest part about working at a record store is you get exposed to a lot more things than a lot of people do.
Yeah.
So I had that luxury. So even though I did like the shitty punk rock that I still find near and dear to my heart, I found a lot of other really cool musicians. So like right now, if you ask me what would have been the first songs I wanted to learn how to play, it would definitely either be a Clash or a Queen song.
Oh,
because
nice.
I think both of those guitarists and guitar parts are very revolutionary. In the music world, and they still stand true. How
they
many people sample them?
Mm-hmm.
How many versions of Queen have there been since Freddie Mercury? That still are pretty good, to be honest with you. I mean,
and the Clash.
Yeah.
Same thing. It's like, I mean, the Clash had something so special, not just in the sound and in lyrically.
I mean, Joe Strummer in general, even from his earlier projects to his later solo stuff.
Yeah.
I think he had a big part in revolutionizing that style of music.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whether it was dance music or punk rock, I mean, he was kind of stuck in between them.
He had that groove.
That's why my argument is that they're my favorite punk rock band of all time. And people are like, what about the Ramones? Well, the Clash put out albums that sounded like the Ramones, but were better.
Yeah.
You know, you could always make that argument, in my opinion. But yeah, if you were going to ask me nowadays what I would have learned at that time, but all of my uncles were like weird metalheads. So like, I did get into Iron Maiden at a very early age. I did get into a lot of like AC/DC and Metallica and stuff at a very early age.
That's what's there.
Which was super cool too.
Yeah. Yeah, totally valid. To talk about the hard.
So between the record store and my uncles, and I wouldn't say my grandparents have much influence on that because they're listening to like disco.
That's hilarious.
Which is hilarious.
See, my grandpa was listening to like Hank Snow. It was like old countries that my grandpa was listening to. So I always joked around, like my mom was from South America, right? So of course the cumbia stuff that came as part of it, but she was into cumbias, operas/musicals, and outlaw country.
Oh.
And I was always like, where'd the outlaw come from? But then as I got to understand the country of Colombia a little more, that made a lot more sense.
Right.
And then my dad was like folky, also musicals, but he liked kind of like the doo-wop-y stuff and all that. So when I rolled around as the eldest kid, I was just listening to the radio all the time. And I think what changed in our family is my mom became a jazzercise instructor. She was one of the first jazzercise instructors in the world. And they gave them all the records. And so this is like late 70s, early 80s. So it's all these pop hits. It's like R&B stuff, all of that. So I still have an amazing 45 collection that jukeboxes would kill for because of my mom's.
I'm so jealous. Like, I collected when I worked at the record store, but then at one point decided these things are too heavy to move.
45s, I know.
Well, just records in general.
Yeah, no, I've whittled down my record collection quite a bit. But the 45s are easier to store because they're small. So I have a couple boxes of those, which is not the best way to keep them. But just in case, they just still come in handy. But I worked in a record store for a minute, too. And I get what you're saying. Just doing this podcast and talking to people about music, working in the record store, working in radio, I think you have this experience. So people probably think you know everything there is to know about music.
No, you'll never stop learning about music.
Exactly.
There's always something in some weird dark corner. Which is easier to find these dark corners now with the internet the way it is.
Well, you can say that.
There's always some artists that like there's this little group of weirdos that they love and that they will talk about, and you don't, and you'll find it eventually, and they'll be like, "You're 20 years late to the right. party." But it's easier to find now, and I think we have more access to that, at least.
It's true.
And
I mean,
you don't have things that go out of print anymore. I don't know if you remember that. Like,
kind of, though.
Jawbreaker's Dear You was out of print for 15 years. How big of an album was that?
Working, though, streaming, though, there are labels that will take things that don't sell enough or stream enough, and they'll take it down to save, like, what, cloud space? I mean, it's very confusing to me. But, no, you're absolutely right, and I think you're the first person that's ever said that to me, so thank you for saying what I always say, is you can never learn it all.
Right.
It's, there's too much out there. There's too much out there.
It's just like the spirits industry. You'll never know everything.
It's true. It's true.
You can say you do, but there's something out there that you do not know. And there might be a method that you don't know. That's how different methods are created.
A couple years ago, I was at Tails, and there's a woman, an American woman, who's running a bar in Bogota, Colombia. And she did a seminar, just a small one of these 30 people in a room thing, about Colombia-specific spirits. Like things that don't get imported here. And I was like, I'm going to that because I haven't been to Colombia in a long time. My family there, they just drink aguardiente and beer. They're not going to take me to some place that has fancy spirits. And it was so revelatory to get to try these things that they're making there that were amazing, incredible spirits that we just don't have access to here, you know, all over the country. So you being beverage director here at Nickel City, like what have you got to play with while you're here? What have been your like discoveries here? Not just with the crowd, but with the drinks that you're making for people.
So we do a lot with a lot of different brands. So every week we have a different whiskey that we have a menu for.
Every week? And,
yeah. We do Whiskey Wednesdays where we feature a different whiskey every week. So I've learned that writing five menus a month is difficult at times to keep the ideas fresh and not repeat them every year, which I've done, I think, a pretty good job of doing.
Okay.
And then we have an LTO menu every month.
That's a lot of R&D.
It is. And we have an LTO menu every month, which is another four drinks on top of that that we have just to kind of keep things fresh and work with different brands, smaller brands that come through the door.
How do you do that? I mean, does it take
a lot of, initially what I'll do is I'll sit down and meet kind of as we are and we'll book all the brands in a spreadsheet for months ahead of time. And then I've got a small team of people that help me with it. You know, I'll give little assignments out here and there for cocktails at the Fort Worth location and some people here as well. It's definitely was a learning experience at first. It was stressful at first. Now I have it down to where I get it done, you know, every day at this time, and sending it to our design team and then getting it to the printer, like, it's pretty set in stone. We recently just lost our printer, which was like heartbreaking because they're right down the street and they just could put up with our bullshit all the time of like me and Travis calling in a menu with like a day to spare kind of deal.
Yeah.
But we found another really great local printer, so that definitely helps.
But still,
as far as learning, I learned that like there's a lot of drinks out there.
Yeah,
because one of them is a known drink. You know, we use a classic format. We use like what we call a lesser known is one of like more modern. One we create and then we do a Boilermaker on it on every menu.
Wow.
So I'm digging in to find the lesser knowns from people.
Yeah.
It has been the interesting thing.
And
yeah.
The creation.
So I'm constantly learning about drinks by just writing all these menus as well.
That
and
sounds
finding
like a crash course every week though. That like hurts my brain.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And we try to burn some old products that we had from old menus through on those too, and getting creative and trying to like regulate inventory by doing that as well. It was challenging and it still is. I don't think it's ever going to get easy, but it's gotten easier.
Job, so you must always have just like all kinds of whiskey. You must have some crazy stockpile of whiskey unless you guys get through it all in a week.
Here, yes. And my personal collection, even probably more than we have in this building. I have unfortunately, I have a 40 by 40 storage unit in Milwaukee still filled with all of my booze.
Oh my God.
I don't know how to move it. You know, it's like one of those things, what if you get in an accident and you lose all this alcohol? And a lot of it's allocated bourbon, so it's
I know someone who rented a U-Haul and drove thousands of bottles of gin from San Francisco to New York. And she was like, I had to hire my friends because I couldn't hire anyone professional because this is a personal collection. And she was trying to stay wary of those rules.
Right.
Hire her friends, and she's like, and of course I'm in a fourth story walk-up, so let's walk up bottles and bottles and bottles and bottles of liquor. It just took like days. Oh my God. That is insane. Well, good luck to you when you ever do get that here.
I might just sell it. Who knows?
I know. You might have to just sell it off. Which, I don't know. That might break your heart, though.
Yeah, at this point, it's almost hoarding.
Okay. Makes
sense. I'm trying to
if you haven't seen it in such a long time, maybe you should ask somebody else to sell it off so you just don't know.
No, I'll definitely be a part of it, but you know, it might be time to shed a few bottles. You know, you can't drink that much.
So then what is the day-to-day here like? I mean, the menus are, I mean, I see so many beautiful bottles back there. And do you, are you guys a whiskey bar or are you in anything bar here?
I would say our focus is on whiskey here, mainly bourbon.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's what I see back there, but don't want to make assumptions.
And then we have, like, outside of bourbon, obviously, as you can see, that's the majority. I mean, we have, like, key things of every spirit genre.
So you must be, I mean, it's fortunate that you forced that mentor on yourself, because you must be quite the knowledgeable
person. Yeah, it's really kind of cool. Right now, we only have about 7 or 8 barrel picks, but we normally have about 15 in-house. Securing those in Texas is kind of a treat in itself in that it goes from manufacturer to the distributor to our class B, then to us. So those sometimes figuring out where those are and when we're gonna actually get them is difficult. We're about a year turnaround on those right now.
Oh
so
my God.
You kind of forget, like, oh, I have all these barrels coming. But yeah, I am very blessed to be able to work with a lot of the allocated stuff here and get to try it.
Yeah. What are some discoveries? Maybe more recently, you've been doing this for a couple of years, so there got to be a couple lately that you've been like, it's been
so my
your
daily
mind.
Drinkers are gonna sound kind of funny. They're always like Yellow Rose or Four Roses, Yellow Label. Very Old Barton is one of my favorites. That's the 175 you always find in my house somewhere, for, like making highballs out of my Soda Stream.
Yeah.
And that and like Elijah Small Batch are always in my house. I've really liked a lot of the Willett family estates that we've seen trickle in, but those again are like really rare unicorns for the bourbon. You see the rye a lot of times.
Yeah. Those made you happy. Well, actually, you just made me think. I always ask when you're home on your own, chilling out, or maybe just sitting with friends, what is your drink and what is your music? It sounds like you do some highballs at home.
Yeah, highball for sure is always my drink nowadays. That machine really has ruined my having anything else in the bar.
What are you and the Corgi listening to?
Man, nowadays, it's really hard to say. It's all over the place still. It's however I'm feeling, I guess.
Well, maybe another question for you would be, since you do come from this like deep music background, really, I mean, you were like in it. When you're in a record store, you're in it. Again, I've worked it too, so I know everybody comes in and they're like, you, I can talk to you about this and no one's going to think I'm weird, and they want to talk about music. So have you taken that opportunity to ever name any cocktails after bands, songs, etc.?
If we have like Jack Daniels comes up as on the menu, you're like trying to think like find classic Jack Daniels recipes. Yeah. No, you're just going to name them all after Lemmy. You know, the whole menu is Lemmy's. Like that's a no-brainer for me. And the people that know, and the people that don't, sorry.
Yeah.
You should be able to figure it out by the one that's called the Lemmy, which is a Jack and Coke with some bitters in it, you know, which was his drink.
God, that's beautiful.
So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of times where if like you're a big music head, there might be a very subtle Easter egg on some of our menus.
Yeah.
On the LTOs especially.
That'd be a couple that you've been proud of.
Yeah, I mean, the Jack Daniels one is probably my most.
You just love doing that.
Yeah. I'll slip a song title in here or there, like if it's a Tennessee whiskey, like a Lucero song title or something like that.
Yeah.
That kind of fits the bill.
Everybody gets it. Yeah. I remember going to a bar sometime and someone had named the drink the Sun-O, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with that band or not. Yeah, so but they included all of the parentheses and the O's and everything. And I looked at that and I was just like, okay, who listens to this? Who actually knows who this is? Because there were like three guys behind the bar, and one of them was like, you know what that is? And I'm like, yes, I do. I love that you put this on the menu, because how many people know what this is in this particular space? And that must be so much fun for you when someone identifies that. You're just like, we have something else to talk about now.
Yeah, there's an Easter egg on the normal menu too. It's actually the name of the theater where Mystery Science Theater was filmed.
Oh my God, I watched that, but I don't know where that was.
It was in Minneapolis. It was called the Golden Triangle. But that's another Easter egg. I think only 3 people have discovered on our normal menu. I just gave it away.
You and my brother would be, I know, for anyone who happens to hear this, you and my brother would be best friends, because not only was he an MSDK3, you know, he was that person, but also Bungle, Rocket. He played music in San Diego at that time. And he was also the kid that was underage. But he was playing bass in these bands where everybody was older than him. So he got to
listening to now, I mean, I'm all over the place. Like, it's been a lot of the Bronx.
I saw that on your.
Yeah,
they love Mariachi El Bronx. I think
same. I think those guys are crazy. Like, they all went to the Music Institute in LA. That's how they met.
Oh yeah.
So Matt's a classically trained singer, which I think is pretty cool, from what I understand.
Yeah.
But the fact that they can pull off both of those things sometimes in the same
set simultaneously. Yeah. I've seen them do both, and I'm just like, And they'll do the same song. They're like, okay, the punk one. Now we're going to come back and do the whole set. But in Spanish with mariachis. I'm like, oh my God.
What a great concept and what a great band.
Why do you have to throw your talent in my face like that?
That's the same thing with Rocket. They can do the same thing. You know, totally. Motown sounding horns with dirty rock and roll. I mean, how do you go wrong with that?
Totally. Well, that must have really appealed to you. You're like, oh, why didn't I use my trombone for that? But you used it for ska. Okay, well, let me ask you. I wanted to ask you this before, the ska question. You know, people laugh at ska. I know that. There's so many jokes about ska. But
ska is amazing.
I love ska. Third wave I was a little meh on, but second and first, totally down with. So what were your ska discoveries where you were like, oh, hey, this is what makes it respectable. You've got to have some that you found that gave you, like, the pride, ska pride.
Man, I don't know. Most of the stuff I like is third wave.
But you still love it. There's no guilty pleasures. If it makes you happy, it makes you happy.
I remember we were touring around with the Pie Tasters. They were pretty cool. They were doing that whole, like, New York style, like, more second wave of ska that wasn't so punky. I saw the Toasters are playing South by Southwest. That was pretty.
Were they?
They're here, like, today, maybe even.
Really?
Yeah, at some house show.
That'd probably be fun.
There's a whole ska day here, which I thought was hilarious.
I think there's always been a ska day here, though, because I feel like I've stumbled into it before.
Yeah.
And they do bring, like Latin ska, you know, here, like, and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, that's fun. I mean, ska has horns. How can you not be happy?
I was like an MU330 guy. You know, like, that was, like, the one I thought that had a lot of talent. I was mainly third wave, more on the punk side of things. I just thought the horns were cool, I guess. I don't know.
It's all good. Well, I mean, there was a lot of third wave, but, I mean, trombone. You were trombone and guitar. There you go.
Right.
Well, that's probably a good spot to end it on, let everyone ruminate on third wave and how it wasn't all that bad.
I mean, some of those bands still kill it. Like, Les and Jake's still out there doing stuff. I think Real Big Fish is probably bigger than they've ever been.
It's like I was saying, ska, you can make fun of it all you want, but it always puts a smile on people's face.
Right.
Pretty much always. I can't think of any ska that actually actively makes people mad. They just like to make fun of it.
I know there's some, like, up-and-comers, like Cat Bite is pretty cool.
Yeah. There's still stuff out there, for sure. And I'm sure I'll get an email.
Like, Jeff Rosenstock is redoing all of his albums as ska albums or something. I saw that pop up, and I'm like, I can't do that. We'll leave that album the way it is, because it's perfect. I don't need to hear the ska version anymore.
It's like George Lucas messing with Star Wars.
Right. Well,
Well, tell everybody where they can find you, the social media stuff, all that, if you want to.
NickelCityBar.com. We're on Instagram. Mm-hmm. You know, we're on all the platforms.
Usual things.
We don't do the TikTok. We don't do Snapchat because we're old people here.
Yeah. Well, also, this is a bar where you come in and sit down and just talk to people, not stare at your phones.
You can see pictures of our Coney dog on Instagram, and that's
Oh my God,
enough.
You guys have Coney dogs here?
We do. The Detroit kind, not the Cincinnati kind.
My husband's from Detroit.
Okay.
As soon as we turn this off, I know what I'm ordering for lunch.
Perfect.
All right, well, thank you so much, Joey. It was so great to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Anybody find me somebody true?
I gotta say that as soon as we wrapped up, I definitely had that Coney dog and the Golden Triangle cocktail. Both were insanely delicious. Nickel City for the win, every time. Thanks, Joey, so much for sitting down with me today. It's always great to visit Austin and the scene there in Nickel City itself. I highly recommend anybody pop by there if you're in Austin. It's delicious and kind of always open, so go check them out. And if you want to check out Joey's playlist, we put something together. You can find that on the Mo Herms Spotify page. And find Nickel City, not Joey. He's keeping a low profile, but you can find Nickel City on the Instagram. Music and Booze with Mo is brought to you by The Mermaid, a cozy neighborhood bar with an aquatic flair in the Little Tokyo area of downtown LA. Open 7 days a week, featuring tropical cocktails and snacks, The Mermaid also has a daily happy hour from 5 to 8 p.m. Follow The Mermaid on Instagram at TheMermaidLA to hear about upcoming events and check them out at TheMermaidLA.com. Head to 428 East 2nd Street, Los Angeles, for a drink. Thank you for tuning in to our barroom chats on Music and Booze with Mo. For more info about today's guest, or if you want to connect with me, check out my Facebook page, Mo Herms. please subscribe to the podcast and feel free to tell all your friends about it. While you're there, give the show a rating and a review. It really helps to get the word out. If you want to hear the playlists our guests have curated, search SheBMO on Spotify, SheBMO. Find pictures of the interviewees and the cool stuff they create on the Music and Booze with Mo Instagram account. Lower your expectations and join us at the bar. Till next time, cheers.